All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what the fucksters, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How's it going? Are you guys all right? Holy shit, man. Today on the show, I talked to Liesl Tommy. She's the director of the movie Respect, which I was in. It's her first feature film, but she has a lot of experience directing for the stage all over the world, I might add. It was a pleasure to work with her. She's a smart, intense person. It was great to talk to her. And you will be able to enjoy that shortly. I let some people in on the on Instagram Live to a band rehearsal. As you know, I am going to be playing music and hosting a comedy show at Largo on the 26th of this month. And I've put together, with Flanagan's help, the guy who books Largo, a little combo. It's me and a guy named Brandon Schwartzel on bass, a guy named Ned Brower on drums. And I've selected these songs, I think some of them for reasons, some of them not necessarily for reasons, just because I like them. But it's an odd collection of songs. I think we're doing six songs. I might do the song I wrote for Lynn at the end, just solo. But, you know, it's coming together. And it looks like Jimmy Vivino, the dude who plays, who's taught me a lot of licks, who's one of my primary guitar teachers, really, over the last couple of decades, who was Conan O'Brien's band leader. He might sit in on a couple, which is very exciting. He's actually going to come to rehearsal next week. But why am I doing this? What am I trying to tell you here? I'll tell you why, because I can. So it is a bucket list situation, but I've been playing guitar for a long time. And I think the hopes on behalf of the establishment, Flanagan over at Largo, is that it goes well and we make it a monthly show. I pick a few other songs. We get a few other comics. Lori Kilmartin's going to do it. And Fahim Anwar are going to be there. So it'll be a couple of songs. And I don't know, man. You know, I got a lot to make up for. You know, there's a lot to make up for in terms of my tremendous lack of confidence or discipline around guitar playing. I've become something of a, you know, unique guitar player for me. I can handle it. And we're doing good songs. They're a good band. But I've had to figure out what guitar and amp. I'm no pro. I just like to plug in. I'm not a nerd. I don't know. I don't have a pedal board that I can lock into. I'm not that detailed. I just want the tone that comes out of the amp when I plug the guitar in. So I'm settling on something. But I guess this is what I wanted to talk about primarily, is that years ago when I did some work for Gibson through Brendan Small, I was paid in a Les Paul Custom. That's a black Les Paul with gold hardware. And you don't see them around a lot, people playing them. I don't know if they're out of style. It's sort of a rock guitar. I don't know, but it's really a top-notch electric guitar. Classic. And when I was in high school, my buddy Dave Bishop played one. You know, I had my copycat Gibson, then I had a Telecaster, but Dave really knew how to play. Even when we were in high school, he was a little older than me, and he just really knew how to fucking rock out. He was sort of a prodigy, and he had this beautiful black custom Les Paul that I just thought was just, I would never be as good or good enough to play that. I kind of feel that way. But because of some of the sound limitations at Largo, in that you can't play a single coil pickup without getting a extreme amount of buzz, that means I can't play the guitars that I'm used to and that I love. So I had to pull the custom out to see if it would work. And I brought it to rehearsal the other day with the Headstrong Deluxe amp straight in with just a boost pedal. And it was revelatory. It's the perfect guitar. And I got that as a homage, as a tribute, as a reminder, as a nostalgia stop that I can take out of its case to remind me of my old buddy Dave Bishop, who passed away. So there's sort of like, I'm honoring that. I'm honoring Dave by playing this guitar, because that's why I got it in the first place, and it just feels right. So it's kind of loaded up that way, the performance, right? But it's loaded up in other ways too, because of the song selections. And maybe I've talked about it, but things are just coming along. You know, making songs your own is where it's always been at for me, because I never had the discipline to mimic anybody effective. I want to bring this up real quick. I want to mention that I've added more dates to my tour. Wednesday, September 22nd, 8 p.m. at the Neptune in Seattle. That's happening. Friday, September 24th at 7 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. That's happening. And the presale for my show at Town Hall in New York City is going on right now. Go to nycomedyfestival.com and use the presale code NYCF. The show is Friday, November 13th at 7 p.m. All that is happening. So some of the songs I'm doing have direct memories attached to them. We're doing a version of The Stroll by The Diamonds, which was a song my dad hit me to. It's got kind of a greasy, strippery rock vibe with a kind of like drone-y sax that we're going to replace with a guitar lick because Jimmy's going to play on that one. Yeah. We're going to do I Walk With Jesus by Spaceman 3 because I was turned on to Spaceman 3 by Jay Dobis. I was way high and he just kept saying like, you know, Jonathan Richman's my good friend and he turned me on to Spaceman 3 and some other psychedelic stuff. But that song just kills me. It's two chords. It's genius. I love it. We're doing What Goes On by Lou Reed in the Velvet Underground because Lou Reed Live in 69 was a transitional album for me. It was a revelatory album for me. I've used that revelatory. I'm using revelatory ubiquity. A lot lately, those two things. So the Velvet Underground Live in 69 just made me understand music in a whole different way. So that's where we get What Goes On. We're going to do, Isis by Bob Dylan, which I think I can make my own. It's hard not to phrase it like Bob, but I just love that story. I'm not even sure what it's about, but it feels like it's about a relationship that I understand. And then we're going to do Broke Down Palace by the Grateful Dead because that's one of the prettiest songs ever fucking written. And if I can just remember the goddamn chords, it might work out okay. And I'm singing all these things and I'm putting myself out there because I have to erase a bad memory. I have a bad memory to erase. And I think I've talked to you about this before. Some of you may not know because you're new here or maybe you don't listen to me, but it's real. It's real. So in an effort, this performance at Largo with my band, I think we'll call them the Three Chords. All the songs have only two or three chords except for Broke Down Palace, which has a fucking mess of chords that are weird changes. They're not hard chords, but if I don't remember it and I fuck it up, it will go against what I'm trying to do here. What I'm trying to accomplish, as I've talked to you about before, is a memory. It's a memory. It's trauma from Lighthouse Arts and Music Camp, where it was the final performance by all the people, you know, doing the performances for the big show at the end of the camp. I put together this little band. All we had to do was get through Johnny B. Goode. But of course, I put together, not being like, I'm just a swappy player. You know, I was even then. And somehow or another, I managed to get all the dudes who, you know, right on cue, soon as we had to fucking perform in the band shell for the entire camp, a couple of them got stoned, a couple of them got drunk. We're fucking 14, 15 years old. And none of them can play, but they were all giggling. I fucking get up there. I couldn't even fucking make it through Johnny B. Goode. I couldn't find the key. The entire thing was a fucking disaster because those are the guys that I hung around with. And the other band that was representing rock music at the camp was just a bunch of music nerds. I don't remember their names anymore, but we fucking bungled Johnny B. Goode. And, you know, I felt like killing myself. The rest of the idiots were just laughing and giggling and whatever. And then the other band got up there and in my memory played an entire Genesis album perfectly. So now the deal with Largo is I can own who I am. I can own the way I play guitar and I'm just going to do it to feel it. And entertain, perform, play music publicly, share. And if I die, this is going to be it. So there's a lot hanging on it. See, I'm already pressuring myself. But I know myself well enough just from all these years that if I don't feel good about what's happening, I can stop in the middle of a song. I give zero fucks. I don't fucking care. I'll be like, we're starting this over. I'll get a laugh. I'll make it weird. And we'll fucking get back on track. I'm going to make this fucking work. This is a fucking an exercise in reversing the effects of the trauma of massive embarrassment. Yeah, that's what's happening. It's a big night. So Liesl Tommy is the director of Respect, and we talked really, the day after the premiere. It's in theaters now. She's an amazing director, very smart, and I enjoy talking to her. So this is that. You know, the guy, the prop guy, set me up with a guitar in my hotel room, and that guitar got lost somewhere. He told me it got stolen or lost. Do you know about it?
I don't know about it. I did not hear that story.
Well, I don't think it was a big story because I don't think a lot of them were very expensive guitars.
Yeah.
They looked the period, but they weren't like, you know, custom shop guitars.
Yeah.
But it somehow got, it disappeared between my room and wherever. I don't know what happened to it. It was upsetting.
Very upsetting. Am I looking at one of them right now?
No, I wouldn't have taken it. I wouldn't have taken that one.
No, I'm sure you wouldn't have.
So last night was very exciting, I thought. Did you?
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I mean, I was one of the journalists on the carpet asked me, how do you feel right now? And I said, I think I'm incandescent with happiness.
Yeah.
And he just was like, what? And I'm like, I'm sure people don't really say that, but this has been such a grueling and you know, scary process because COVID stuck itself into the middle of it.
Yeah,
you know?
I know. Well, at least in the release, right?
I mean, well, no, because we wrapped last year in the end of February, and then you know, I had a week off, and then I dove into the edit in New York City, and we were editing, and we were in the edit bay for maybe 7 days, and then we got shut down because of COVID.
Oh my God! And it was such a massive editing job.
And I basically, we all had to retreat to our apartments, and I was in my apartment in Harlem, listening to sirens 24 hours a day,
so
editing the film alone.
It was so brutal in New York at the beginning. I mean, it was devastating.
It was devastating. I mean, you know, I had a lot of friends in the Broadway community. And people got sick. People died.
Yeah.
You know, it was, we really did not know what was happening. And concentrating on work was like an act of just epic will, because we were just, I was talking to writers, you know,
of the
friends, and they were like, we have no bandwidth. We can't focus on anything. All we want to do is check the news.
Oh, I know. Yeah. I mean, I talked to creative people that were sort of like, should I be working? Yeah. I mean, like, well, after people realized that we were in it for a while, there was this feeling like, well, I should be using this time.
Yes.
But few people did. And then you resented people who said they were using it. Like, you know, it's like, who the fuck is this person?
I know. How what skill do they have that I don't have that
how
they can actually focus?
Be inspired and motivated during this plague.
No, man. I mean, it was just, we've never experienced that kind
of. No, of course not.
You know, but what I kept thinking about is people who live in Syria or Yemen.
Yeah.
Or people who are living, you know, harrowing, war-torn lives daily for years.
Or like, just like,
how,
you know,
do you keep your nervous system together?
Broken structure, lack of resources. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know. But people do adapt, you know.
Yes. I mean, it's amazing what we adapt
for better and worse.
Yeah.
You know, some people become completely delusional and just commit to a fucking fiction as a way of life. And other people try to deal.
For real, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, that was 2020 was just, you know, editing a music movie without being able to like feel the vibe with a group of people in a room.
Oh, right. So there was, you could just pass around these cuts to individuals. Yeah. So there was no real way to screen. Well, what the hell? I mean, what's the movie at now, time-wise?
225.
225. So I imagine at the beginning, when you wanted to start testing things out, what was it, at like nine hours?
Okay, so the assemblage, the first cut of the, you know, the editors was like 5.5 hours. And my favorite moment in
Did
the
you have
early
a place
process,
for the intermission? Was
there, like, there was a dinner break, I showed the movie to Tracy, the writer, when it was like, I just wanted her to see the whole thing because I knew I was going to have to get in there and cut the words, you know.
So this is the whole thing as,
5.5
as the
hours,
script.
Just like purely as written.
Right.
And she was just like, so happy. She was just beaming and she didn't take her eyes off the screen for 5.5 hours.
Yeah.
And then I showed her, like, I managed to get it down to 3 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah.
She watched it kind of stone faced and then she said to me, I feel like the 5.5 hour version flowed better.
Yeah. No kidding.
And I was like, God, I love writers.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, sure.
And of course, she loves it now, but it's just everything.
She was willing. She was willing.
So painful.
To release it at 5.5. Yeah. People adapt. They adapt.
Like, you know, Angels in America was a two-part, you know. Yeah. I was like, yes, this is true.
We could release half now and release the other half in 6 months.
But, you know, that's why I love her so much. She's so passionate. She's, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can't imagine, like, it must have been difficult. I mean, I don't know what the choices were. I guess I could ask you, because I didn't know who you were coming into it. I'm not even sure. How did you find me? Because you got someone decided I was the guy, right?
Yeah. I mean, I saw Glow. Yeah. I thought you were awesome in that.
Oh, thanks.
You know, I have a style of acting that I respond to. And it's like, I don't want people to think they're watching actors act. I want people to feel like they're watching people live their lives. And you have that.
Oh,
it's
good.
Just super organic. It's real. It's direct. You know, it's no bullshit. And that's what I responded.
Well, I thought I did pretty well. I watched
it. You did great. What are you talking about? Yeah. I mean, the fact that you could actually like watch yourself and like it, that always tells you.
What, right. Well, I mean, I've grown. That's gotten easier for me.
Yeah.
And Forrest Whitaker, Jesus.
Yeah.
Because, well, that's, we can stay on the story of respect for a while, is that, because, you know, I talked to David Ritz, and I talked to, who wrote the was it an autobiography with her, or did he do a biography?
He did two. He did one authorized and one unauthorized. Yeah,
okay. So I talked to him about Jerry, because he did Jerry's too, and then I interviewed him about stuff, and I know that he wasn't really involved in this one, but there is this notion about, you know, her life and mysteries about her life that have not really come to light or come to pass. And it had to be worked around for you to get permission to do this story. So what it was, where did this journey to do her story begin, and why you?
Good question, because it was my first movie.
Yeah, I mean, you were a Broadway director, really, right?
Theater director, and I did television for a couple of years.
Okay.
I always wanted to make movies, you know.
Yeah, of course.
And you know, there was a period where I was like, I had a show on Broadway that did extremely well, and I did this big thing for Disney, this adaptation of Frozen. I was like, I think I've directed my bucket list in theater,
right?
You know.
Yeah.
And then I moved into TV, but I got this. I was actually directing The Walking Dead in Atlanta.
Yeah.
When I was told that the studio and Scott Bernstein, the creative producer, was going to call me about this movie.
So Walking Dead, huh?
I love zombies. I do. I'm a total genre geek.
Well, I mean, that's a pretty theatrical undertaking. You got to get a bunch of zombies going for the crowd scenes.
Got to stage them.
Yeah.
Like, it's like Shakespeare when everybody's on stage at the end of the final part of the play.
Right. Or like the end of a musical.
That's right. Exactly.
So how many of those did you direct?
I only directed one.
Oh.
But I plan on directing a full zombie movie in the future, so it was good practice.
Really? That's the next one?
Wouldn't that be funny? Movie? Like, it's a horror movie. That's my next
thing. Full zombie. Maybe you should make it a musical zombie biopic.
So they, you know, I was in the hotel in Atlanta during prep for this episode, and they said they were going to call me, and I knew that it was about as big a long shot as it could get for me to bag this film, having not done
it.
But
did you know you were in the running?
All I knew is that someone had given them their name, and they were calling
your name.
My name, and they were calling me.
Yeah.
And it was just a chat. It was just like a general chat.
Right.
But, you know, I just knew I couldn't afford a general chat. So I had like a whole pitch planned. I said it should start in the church. It should end in the church. I had a tagline. I said the songs. I talked about the style.
Yeah.
I said it's childhood in her 20s. I don't personally like birth to death biopics. I feel like it just, everything feels rushed.
Yeah.
Everything's like you cramming stuff in.
And then you got to make makeup decisions.
It's just like, I just wanted to really feel like we were in there with her.
Yeah.
And it would just be a specific time period to get to know how she became.
And you were thinking thinking in terms of story too. That
absolutely.
There's an arc within the whole life, or several. So you're like, well, here's the arc.
Yes.
That makes the most sense.
That's right. I mean, I'm always thinking, this comes from, you know, being a dramaturgical director.
Right.
What is the beginning, middle, and end of any story?
Yeah.
What's the central conflict?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So what I pitched them was that this should be a movie about a woman with the greatest voice on earth who did not know what her voice was.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty smart. How'd you figure that out? What were they thinking? They had no ideas?
To be brutally honest,
they
actually got confused, because after I did the pitch, they were like, wow, that's pretty great. And then they said, You talk like a director. Are you a director? And I was like, dudes,
wait,
I am
what?
A fucking director. And they were like, oh, you don't want to write it? No, I'm a director. We should hire a professional writer to write it.
Right.
And then they were like, oh, sorry. We just got confused. You know, they were like, we'll get back to you. And we all kind of fled the call. And I was like, motherfucker.
How'd that get? Where was the drop in communication? Where was the miscommunication?
You know,
who told them I was a writer?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then, but they actually came back 2 weeks later. And they were like, we really like that take. We were going to start with a writer, but we're going to bring you on. And we're going to make that movie.
Oh, wow. So it was like that. So you got to choose Tracy?
Yeah.
Huh. And what was your relationship? What's her last name again?
Tracy Scott Wilson.
What's her history with you?
So we did a play together in like, I don't even know what year, 2005.
Yeah.
You know, we were baby theater people.
Uh-huh.
She wrote this play called The Good Negro about the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
And I directed it. We developed it for like 4 years together. And then
we
did it together. And, you know, you kind of go through fire when you work with somebody that long. And I just knew she was the person. I knew that I had a shorthand with her and that, you know, the ideas that I had for the film. I mean, there were certain scenes that just came to me that I knew had to be in the film. Like, I had this vision of that scene with her and her mom.
Mm. At the piano or at the end?
The end.
Uh-huh.
And I just was like, this is
a vision of the vision.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, I was just kind of like, we called it the dark night of the soul. And
yeah.
I just knew what it would be and that it should, you know, and I knew that I could trust Tracy to, you know, to hear those crazy visions and make them work.
Well, I thought that you staged that really well. I thought that by that time, you know, like you didn't really know, unless you really knew the story of Aretha, where this was going. But I thought you handled that well. I thought Jennifer did a really good job with that because... You know, you really are. I was talking to somebody today. When you do a biopic of any kind, you're really encapsulating a myth of a person. You know, and these stories sort of, you have to choose which stories
Correct.
That many people may know. How do you capture those? And you're all in service of this, of feeding the idea that you want to get across about this woman. Like, there's no, like, you can't waste any time.
That's right. That's right. I mean, you know, people were like, well, what about this? Or what about, you know, CL grew up in, you know, and we have to focus on Aretha. And I've got the spine of the story and every scene has to further that story.
Well, it was when I watched it again last night, you know, I really realized the sort of the kind of weight that Forrest, you know, the burden he had to sort of be the anchor of darkness for the whole movie. Like, you know, whatever the reality of her story is, it's deeper and darker than is revealed here, and it revolves around him. So you had to sort of, you know, he was a very hard character to empathize with and a very hard character to respect in some ways because he was, but, you know, he made some decisions about how he's going to play that guy where whatever was going on inside of that dude, you could see it and feel it.
That's right. I mean, that's the thing that I am attracted to with certain actors.
Yeah.
Forrest is definitely one of them. You're one of them. Everybody on that in that film.
Yeah.
Whereas no matter good guy, bad guy, who cares?
Yeah.
You are fascinated by what's going on inside of them.
Yeah.
You know, I just never get tired of looking at Forrest Whitaker think.
Yeah. It's crazy.
You know,
crazy.
It's so complex. And, you know, he's just, he's gifted.
Yeah.
He has an emotional complexity that is so inspiring to work with.
Yeah. And for that guy.
Yeah.
It was kind of great.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it's the same. That character was never going to be an easy character. And it would have been in the wrong hands, would have just tilted into just one dimensional bad guy.
Well, yeah. Right. But there were some scenes like, you know, where he is somewhat redeemed at the end. Mm-hmm. And also, but like the thing I didn't like, because I only saw it, this is the second time I saw it on the big screen, was that, you know, when he and Aretha are both sitting there drinking after Martin Luther King dies and you start to realize like, oh, see, like, you know, they're both sitting there drinking almost the same drink.
Exactly.
You know, like I didn't really sort of notice that stuff, that the demon in her was him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's right.
You know,
we all have baggage, you know, and that's part of the journey of the film.
And also, you know? Like the weird kind of like, and when I read about Jerry, it was the same thing. There was these people in that business at that time, you know, like parenting was certainly the secondary.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just, and you sort of have to encapsulate that very quickly where, you know, basically, you know, the grandmother just takes the kids. And I think that's what usually happened. Mm-hmm. Here you go. Mm-hmm. Here's another one.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just somebody has to take care of them.
Yeah.
Somebody has to take care of them. And, there was certainly no infrastructure for women to have their... It's still that way, to have their own careers. So,
right.
You know, it's not like your husband in the 50s and 60s was going to decide to be the parent.
No. Yeah. I mean, like, I read stuff about Jerry. Like, that family situation was kind of turned out very sad.
Yeah.
But, okay, so you guys kind of set out to do this. What was the relationship with the Franklin estate in terms of what you could and couldn't do? How was that dictated?
There was really nothing that they said I could or couldn't do.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, they were busy with their own, after she died, there was a lot of stuff they had to sort out legally themselves around her estate. So Tracy and I just did our thing.
Okay.
You know, and the executor, her niece, you know, she came onto set and Brenda, also one of the backup singers, and her, you know, and a cousin came onto set and they were awesome.
Yeah.
You know? And I got to say, maybe because, you know, when they met with us, they saw Tracy and I, black women, we were not about to fuck up Aretha Franklin's legacy.
Sure.
And they really trusted us, you know, and we were very... I was like, if I'm on this, I need to have artistic freedom.
And there was no line. I mean, because I know that there were things that, you know, that we don't even need to talk about here that were sort of danced around and suggested that, you know, would have been, I would have probably thrown a wrench in the movie, right? Around her children and, you know, where they came from.
Well, I mean, I took my lead on that from, she said different things at different times in her life about
where that. They came from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
About who the fathers were.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, that's actually fascinating. It's part of the story. And so that's, you know, I'm going to go with that.
And you just did it in two ways. You know, you did the when she was the kid, and then you did
with Mary J's
character going like, when are we going to find out?
Mm-hmm.
Who? Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like I don't have genetic tests. I don't know who you know. And I got to go with the fact that she chose to be mysterious about that.
Yeah, and how was it? How did it all come together with Jennifer? Like, I mean, she was the one who was supposed to do it by Aretha, per Aretha's request. Who found that? How did that all come together?
So here's something fascinating. You know, Jen and I were reunited in Martha's Vineyard last week for the African-American Film Festival. We had a screening there and we were just hanging out talking. And we realized that we were Broadway neighbors together in 2016. I had my show Eclipsed on Broadway, and next door she was doing Color Purple.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We used to call it Black Way because that was, you know, because I think like Hamilton was running at the same time and Forrest was doing Huey, I think, at the same time. Like this crazy, we called it like the, you know, Broadway block. But we were neighbors, and that was when Aretha Franklin asked her to play her in the film.
Whatever the film might be.
Yeah.
She was like,
you were going to play me in the film.
Right.
And, you know, we were just talking about how that was 2016, and we didn't even, you know, we had no idea that we would be doing this together then.
Who made the decision to make this movie? I mean, where did it come from?
Well, Scott Bernstein and Harvey Mason Jr. Had worked together on Straight Outta Compton. And Harvey...
Producers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Harvey had, you know, was her music producer for a while.
Oh, okay.
They put it together and she was like, yeah, let's do this. And then, you know, there's some interview where somebody got a little like spicy with her about like, how long, why is this movie taking so long? And she was like, do you know anything about contracts? And she's not wrong. I mean, you know, every song is owned by a different entity, you know, so it's a long process.
Oh, the different labels, and she didn't have ownership
individuals
of some of them.
And I mean, like Ted White, had her ex, Ted White had you know, control over some of them. It was It was, you know,
so he did all right for himself for life.
He did.
Out of a few songs. Is he still alive?
No, he passed last year, actually.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow. And how many kids are there?
There are four sons.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And they're around?
Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They all came. They were. Some of them were there last night.
Oh, really? How did they feel about it?
They love it.
They do?
Yeah. I mean, we had a screening for them in Detroit. Jen and I stopped off in Detroit for a couple of days this past week.
Uh-huh.
And we had a screening for them, and it was very emotional. Well, one thing that I can tell is people are still grieving her loss.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. It's very alive.
Yeah. And just to hear those songs done like that.
Yeah.
And to see that story. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are the reviews like?
I don't know.
You don't know? You haven't seen any of them?
No, I haven't. I mean...
I don't know if they're out yet. Some, probably
there
are, be out
there
this
were a
week.
Few that were out last night, and my friend Jenny Lodge, or like my producing partner, she read some things to me, and there's some great things out there right now. Yeah.
Oh, good.
But I mean, I just feel like, let me get the movie out first before I dive in.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just
scan them for my name.
Type in the search, Mark Maron.
Maron, respect. Two sentences. Maron as Wexler did a fine, convincing job. That's a good review.
It's like, that was a rave. We're a hit.
Yeah, I did it. So how did this all, where did you evolve from? Do you know, like in terms of, so you were a theater director, but where do I know you come from South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Like really come from there?
Yeah, I was born and raised in South Africa, in Cape Town, South Africa.
I'd have no idea what that's like.
Yeah.
Zero.
So in South Africa, you know, during apartheid, as you Americans say, we say apartheid.
Yeah.
It was, you know, systemic racism legally.
Right.
You know, in the Constitution.
Yeah.
So I grew up in what's called a colored township, and colored is what they called mixed race.
Huh. And there was a difference between black, colored,
so what they
white?
Did is they created townships for Indian people, townships for for colored people, and then black people, but then they even went further and separated them by tribe.
Uh-huh.
So that was just, everybody was separated, and it was a way to control.
But fenced in or just block to block kind of stuff?
Block to block, and then they created what, you know, we call them homelands, but they're the equivalent of reservations.
Okay,
and then
so totally separate.
To right. Totally separate, yeah.
Wow.
I know.
I had no idea. I should know that, I guess. I don't know.
Well, it's, you know, it's so specific. And the colored community, the community I'm from, you know, unlike mixed race, when people think about it here, it's my parents were mixed, their parents were mixed, their parents were mixed. Like mixing started very early on.
Wow.
So the Dutch brought in slaves from Indonesia and Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, the mixture of European, mm-hmm. Asian.
So do you know the breakdown?
African. My breakdown?
Yeah.
No, I mean it's black. It's black African. It's Indian. It's indigenous.
Huh.
Khoisan. It's, you know, it's all in there.
But it's very different than whatever mixed would be here.
Yes, it is.
Yeah,
it is different. Yeah, because it's generations of it.
Generations, and it depends on the history of the country. It's mm-hmm. totally different place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so that was the my childhood, and we grew up in a place called Factoryton, which is a, you know, pretty, it was called Factoryton because everybody worked in factories.
Is this how your dad worked in a factory?
No, my dad was a high school teacher.
Oh.
And, you know, he was a very political person, and he worked at a high school that was known for its student activists.
Oh, and your mom?
And my mom worked, she left school very early, and she went, you know, the women in her family had to leave school like before the seventh grade for the most part.
Yeah.
Because so that the brothers could get an education.
Really?
Yeah, it's pretty normal.
So like there was no room? So they had to take up whatever work the family?
And contribute so that, yeah.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Huh.
But she, you know, she's an incredible woman, and she basically, when she retired, she was like a controller for a huge engineering firm.
Uh-huh.
She was just somebody who started off as a secretary, became a bookkeeper, became an accountant, became, you know, she just,
yeah,
very savvy. And then she also, when they went back to South Africa, so,
they,
you know,
went
we
back?
Yeah, so we immigrated to the States when I was 15.
So by having a father who was, you know, in tune with the revolution, or the possibilities of that type of progress, that kind of freed your mind?
yeah.
informed your...
Oh,
your...
yeah. Listen, my dad gave me the Communist Manifesto to read when I was 11.
yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if you know any Marxists, but being well-read is extremely important. Being able to defend an argument is extremely important. So, like, as a kid at dinner, you're like, well, I feel like... And there was no, there's no feeling like.
Uh-huh.
What is the evidence based on that, you know, on the
oh,
statement?
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
It was intense.
So, genuine critical thinking applied.
Genuine critical thinking at the dinner table.
Yeah.
You know, like,
oh,
just no, no nonsense, no meandering. You have to have clear thoughts. And, you know, and you would get really reprimanded if you couldn't defend your position.
So you got to really choose to speak
exactly.
about whatever it is. If
whatever
you have a position,
is, that's correct. That's
I imagine
correct.
Some things. There was a little leniency around, you know, preferences of food and whatnot.
Yes, that was acceptable. But you know, the thing is, when you grow up in a country that's undergoing struggle and revolution, this kind of thing is not a joke. It's not theoretical. You know, I was really raised to one day run a country. That was the expectation, that you would grow up and participate in a political system and creating a civil society.
Well, it's interesting because in America, which is supposedly an advanced country, the actual relationship between the civic structure and people is very vague to most people. Mm-hmm. They don't have any idea of what government's supposed to do or what it was built to do. Either they know that they hate it for these like weird ideological reasons, or they believe that it could be better and service the people more. But it must have been much different to grow up in a place that was legally segregated in so many ways, and it was very clear every day who was free and who wasn't to do certain
That's
things.
That's absolutely correct. And we all have, you know, a story of in our childhood when we realized that we were not free.
Yeah.
Every, you know, my cousins and I sometimes still like tear up when we talk about it. Somebody was five when they realized that they couldn't go, you know, into that store or something.
Right.
You know, it's really
What was yours?
Visceral. My cousin and I were going to see a movie
because
I loved going to the movies.
Yeah.
And my uncle picked us up and they were having tea with at another uncle, and so we were in a town, like a little city that we weren't usually in. And they were going to drop us off to go to the movies with my cousin and then pick us up afterwards. And we went to buy the ticket, and there was like a 15-year-old white girl. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, whites only. And we just all
like that.
Stood looking at each other. And I'll never forget this because it's just like so typical of like how it is to be black person on the receiving end of that. And I went, and she just had this look of like confusion and like just, and I went, oh, sorry. No. Okay, so sorry. And I like apologized to her for trying to buy a ticket from an establishment I didn't belong in. And I turned my cousin and I away, and we were like, you know, eight. And we went to the car and I said, Uncle Edgar, they're not going to let us in. And he said, why? And I said, it's whites only. And they just, my uncle and my aunt just, their faces just fell. And I could see they were then reprimanding themselves for not figuring that out. And exposing us to being, it was just like this cycle of horror.
Well, because the first response is that, you know, you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
As opposed to like, this is fucked
exactly.
up.
Exactly. Yeah.
Who the fuck are you? And and her weird kind of like self-consciousness.
Totally.
The cashier, right?
Because, you know, the thing is, with those kinds of the whites only, coloreds only, blacks only thing was so clear that white people were never actually exposed to having to say, sorry, this is whites only.
Right.
So she was just completely thrown that she actually had to say that out loud.
Right. Wow. And it probably, I don't know, I wonder if it had any effect on her.
Who knows?
How long, but that system was in place so long, huh?
It was in place so long. I mean, we left in the, you know, in the 80s during the state of emergency. And
for safety?
Yeah. It was time to leave.
Huh.
And my dad had gone to MIT on a Fulbright and studied urban planning. In the 70s.
Uh-huh.
So he had contacts in Boston,
uh-huh.
you know, that place of racial harmony.
Sure.
And we ended up leaving South Africa.
The most segregated city in the country.
Correct. Yeah.
I went to school there. And, you know, when you go back there and and I started my doing comedy there, you're like, wow, this place really hides their black people.
They
and it's like, it's not like New York that has black neighborhoods, but everybody's sort of around.
Mm-hmm.
Like in Boston, like they're not even around.
No, it is like those this in terms of like urban planning.
Yeah,
it is very clear where it was then.
Yeah,
at least,
yeah, you West know? Roxbury and, yes. And Columbia Point,
and all Southie. Of you know.
Yeah,
and so we immigrated then, and I went to high school in a place called Newton, Massachusetts, which was
sure
very,
Newton. Yeah, it was very, actually Roxbury was the black part. West yeah, Roxbury was
that's
Jews.
Right. Correct.
Yeah, I went to school there too. So you were in. You went to. When did you guys move there?
85.
Okay, and you were how old?
15.
So Newton, that's nice.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's very nice. So what happened was my dad asked his people where was the best public school, and they said Newton, and he said, okay, well, can you help us find a place in Newton? And they did, and then we got there, and we were like, it's all white people. Like, it was all wealthy white people.
Yeah.
And I was one of the few, you know, black kids in the school. It was really
intense. They must have been so thrilled to have allowed you to go there in Newton. All the nice Jews and Catholics are
well,
like,
yeah,
I mean, finally have one.
they were like a handful of us, like on one hand.
Yeah.
And then they also had this program called the Metco program, where they bussed kids from Dorchester, Roxbury,
right.
You know, Mattapan into the
Mattapan that's
into
it.
The
yeah.
you know the school, and these kids were like traveling for an hour or more, getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning
just to go to school with white people. What a gift.
What a gift. And, you know, I'll never forget that first day. I was like, lunchtime, I looked around at all these white kids, and then there was a table of black kids.
Yeah.
And I just went to go sit there. And they were like, who the fuck are you? I was like, my name is Liesl. I'm here from South Africa.
Yeah.
And they were like, first of all, you don't look African.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow. So you're getting it from all sides.
And they were like, and you don't sound African. I was like, well, I'm sitting my ass down at this table. Sort yourselves out.
Yeah, I don't know that I really was able to, you know, thoroughly, you know, it was fairly recent for me. It was probably with Ta-Nehisi Coates' book around understanding that self-consciousness of the black body or being in a black body at all times. Even with black people at some point. So like and that generated some an ability for me to have at least some understanding or attempted empathy around that, just the daily discomfort and self-consciousness. I can't. It's insane.
It is insane. It is insane, you know, because you could never go a day without having to think about it.
Yeah. And when did you start engaging with the idea of performance and acting and theater? Was that in Newton?
Yeah, it was. You know, it was really rough. I just felt so alienated. No one knew what apartheid was. No one knew where South Africa was. They thought, you know, that was a region, not the name of a country, you know, and people were dying. I left a culture where we were talking about politics and making a better life every day.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, welcome to Dum Dum Land.
Well, it's just, it was rough.
Yeah.
And then a teacher asked me if I wanted to do a play for Black History Month called For Colored Girls Who've Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. And I was like, yeah. And, you know, she was like going up to the five black kids.
Yeah, yeah. We need you.
To this play.
Time to step up.
Exactly. And I loved it. It was so wonderful. I just absolutely loved it. And
the acting?
The acting, the interacting with literature.
Yeah.
You know, the like just spending
having
time
the words.
With language like that and just all of it. And also, you know, finding a community of people who love to read, you know, who love to talk about this, you know, the stuff that you have to talk about when you work on a play or, you know. And I just, I loved it. And then I did a deep dive and started reading all this other, you know, Black American literature, plays, and so on.
Like what at first moved you the most?
I started reading August Wilson.
Yeah. The plays?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The plays. And, you know, and then I started reading poetry like Langston Hughes and Maya Angelou. I didn't know, you know, some of these Black American writers. I mostly knew African writers.
Yeah.
And I was just so moved by this literature.
Well, that's interesting. It must have been sort of, you know, with the promise of America on the minds of many of those black writers and the promise broken, must have been very different than the sort of prolonged acceptance of segregation in South Africa. The language of freedom must have been totally different.
Listen, the colonial struggle is very different than, you know,
the freed the slave
that's
struggle.
That's correct.
Hmm.
Yeah. The legacy, you know, just the relationship towards bondage in this country versus the bondage of a colonial nation. It's just, you know, different. Yeah. Very nuanced, but it's different.
Yeah, I again, this is something in the last decade that I sort of was really made aware of, mm-hmm. through art, on some trip to London, I think, at a museum, just, you know, real, because in Europe, I mean, that is the racism they address. It's post-colonialism.
Yes, exactly.
And that language isn't even here. Mm-hmm. We're just fully trying to educate ourselves on what we have here, which is a indentured servitude, mm-hmm. slavery-based mm-hmm. racism. Mm-hmm. So the whole colonial racism, I was like, wow, mm-hmm. this is a whole other trip, man. And it's most everywhere else in the world.
Correct.
Other than here.
That's correct.
Yeah.
No, it's exactly. And so, you know, just being able to kind of immerse myself in literature, in culture, in art, I started to feel like a human being again. I started to feel like a person that had purpose.
What was the experience of what was being offered to you as, and was, I imagine, very real freedom here?
Right. That's the real thing is, I think I signed up for every single extracurricular activity that the school provided because I was so overwhelmed with choice.
Yeah, I bet.
That no one was telling me, you can't be in this club.
Right, right. You might have got some towny stink eye at places, right? But towny stink eye is different than a law.
Oh, that's correct. Oh, man, is that true? So true. Yeah, no, I mean, I felt like I was in Disneyland. Once I kind of found my way, I was like vice president of my class. Right. I was in Model UN. I was in the dance club. Wow. I was just like, I had terrible grades because I was so busy.
Right. But I mean, with
busy being free.
But right. And but with the interests that were sort of built in you from your father and from, just having a mind that was progressive, it must have been just amazing to fill it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
It was, and I do have like a voracious curiosity.
Yeah.
And I love people, and every one of those clubs you get to meet new kids and talk to them. And, and I just, I had friends in every corner of the school, which was better than the sad shut-in that I was in the beginning. My mom, God bless her, would take me to the movies because I had no friends. You know what I mean?
Oh,
like,
wow,
it was that was how it goes.
It's a sad kid life.
Yeah. But it changed.
Yeah.
And
when
theater helped me change
stuff.
That. Yeah, theater helped
theater
me.
Theater did
helped
it.
It changed.
Freed you. Saved your
life.
Literally
saved my life.
You were
with
the weirdos.
I wasn't even with the weirdos. I was alone, and then I was with the weirdos.
Yeah, right. Finally, the weirdos. Saved by the weirdos.
Totally.
Theater kids are always saved by the weirdos. It's like the greatest. I've talked to a lot of them. So you just pursued it, and you didn't go back to South Africa, or you did?
No. So when I was in grad school in Rhode Island, Mandela was freed. Mandela was freed.
Yeah.
And they needed qualified black people to come back. And they asked my dad. He was an urban planner.
What was the family experience around Mandela being freed?
Oh, I mean, it was euphoric. It was, we didn't actually think it could happen in our lifetime. We were always so afraid that he would die in prison.
Yeah.
It was, it was this terrifying, terrifying prospect that, what would happen
if he died.
Yeah. That scene in the movie where Forrest Whitaker says to her after MLK dies, who's going to lead us now.
Right.
And that was something that I felt like we lived with all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so when he was freed, it was just like, it was just
crazy.
It was like a religious experience.
Yeah.
And then they asked my dad to come back. And
were you crying at home?
My God. No, we were. And then he came through Boston to like that hat shell.
Yeah.
And we went, to listen to him speak. Yeah. And it was just like, it was insane.
I can't imagine.
It was insane.
Yeah.
And as my dad said, when he heard him speak the first time when he came out and he spoke at the parade in Cape Town.
Yeah.
He said his politics remains uncompromised, which was like great.
Did it ultimately?
Listen, when he became president,
you got to do what you got to do. As
economic pressures, certainly there are people who wish that he would nationalize the mines, that he would take all that money away from all the white people, Europeans who owned it, and redistribute.
Yeah.
But the wrath of the capitalist rest of the world would have killed that country.
Isn't it interesting that, you find over time that, it's most governments become puppets of some kind or another. And you know, the ones that really don't are sort of totalitarian or fascistic. And you know, it's
hard to resist the forces of the power of the market, the hammer that is the market.
Yeah, well, that's the way the whole thing's built.
Yeah, it's literally the way the whole thing's built. Yeah. And, you know, if I learned one thing growing up in a Marxist household is that economic systems are world systems. Yeah. So if you're either everybody has to be Marxist or communist or everybody has to be, you know, capitalist, and even the more socialist countries, you got to hold on to the ruling system is capitalism.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely not the democracy business.
Say it.
That idea.
Shit. So, you know, it was, I remember actually, this is a funny story. When I was in high school, a history teacher, because of course it's the 80s, it's the Cold War.
Yeah.
There was the segment where he was explaining communism, socialism,
right,
and capitalism to the class. Yeah. And I will never forget that he said, I know you guys, so you did the reading on what communism and Marxism and socialism is. And I mean, I bet that it sounded kind of good. And he did this motion with his hands where twisted it around. Yeah. Kind of good. But I'm here to tell you that it is never going to work. Uh-huh. And, you know, the system, our system is the system that makes the most sense. Those were experiments. And I was sitting in the back, horrified, because of course at this point that was just like opposite to everything I'd been taught,
right?
And I went home to my dad and I was like, you know what they were telling the children today in history class? And I explained this whole thing, and he just like shook his head and he goes, Americans, he goes, just don't say anything, don't pretend you've never heard of any, you've never heard of any of it before.
Put your head down while we're here. You don't want to be identified as one of them.
I know.
Yeah, but you must have, though, by the time you got to college, you must have been able to sort of aggregate everything you came from and everything you were learning into some identity.
Totally. And the identity was a performer.
A performer.
Actor, theater person. That was the identity.
But what about sort of black woman, you Marxist?
Know, No, I mean, it was never easy because... Yeah. You know, I had a whole culture and a whole identity that I came from that was not American.
Yeah.
And I had a whole identity with struggle that was not American.
Yeah.
And so at times, you know, I think that was difficult to negotiate without seeming like I was above it or I was separate from it.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm just a person who approaches things with a lot of analysis.
Yeah.
You know, like I was trained to... You know,
speak
about politics. Yeah. You know, with a kind of cool intellectual rigor,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, not always endearing.
Sure, and also, you know, not, you know, that popular.
Exactly.
In just general conversations, I would imagine with medium informed Americans, mm-hmm. at a student level.
Absolutely. And I also, when any conversation about race happened, I always wanted to talk about class.
Which is not the conversation here.
But it should be.
Of course. But I mean,
of course. And it felt like I was either avoiding it or I was, you know, the question of race, or I was trying to, you know, but I was just like, I don't know how to talk about race without talking about class.
Yeah.
I was so fun to be around.
Right. Well, I mean, but those are the real conversations. But somehow or another, this culture, this country, you know, I think in order to keep the blindfolds on the lower classes who believe they're just a paycheck away from middle class, have somehow negated that conversation.
100%.
And only until, like, you know, Bernie Sanders brings it up, people are like, what's he talking? Like, yeah, there's, it happens here.
100%.
We can talk politics, but so how does, when does acting in and of itself become limited to you?
After grad school, I moved to New York, and I had been directing things all along.
So where'd you go to undergrad?
I actually didn't go to undergrad.
Huh.
I got into Brandeis University like a good Jewish girl from Newton, Massachusetts. I totally absorbed that culture.
Yeah.
And I dropped out, and then my dad forced me to go back, and I went to like BC, BU. I went through all of the BE schools in Boston. Because I just wanted to do theater, and he was...
You didn't study theater anywhere?
I finally had to like I had to get my, I escaped to London.
Yeah.
I did this program at Oxford where I studied, you know, classical theater. And then I got to London because a woman who taught at, Clara Davidson, who taught at this, at that program in Oxford, had a school, a drama school in London, and she offered me a place there. And I had to, like, basically tell my parents, I am not going to go to law school.
Yeah.
This is what I'm going to do.
Oh, wow,
and
yeah.
And I had to, like, put an ocean between us to get the courage up to tell, like, to really say this is what I'm doing.
Yeah. How did it land?
Not well.
Yeah.
It's very, like, typical immigrant story.
No, I know, yeah. What are you doing?
Exactly. You know, but I just...
Do you know what we went through?
Exactly. All the sacrifices for this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it was a compulsion. There was no other choice. Yeah.
Well, that's good. I mean, it's a gift to have that and a curse.
Yes.
Yeah.
So true. But so I studied, you know, acting at this place. And then when I was done, I came back to Boston. I worked at a place called Project Afrique, which was a experimental federally funded program in Roxbury to take care of families at risk. And I worked with the toddlers of these families. I was a preschool teacher.
At risk, what does that include?
It includes, you know, issues of drug abuse in the family, you know, violence in the family.
Right.
And it was an attempt to kind of holistically, from all sides, which is what holistic means, help mothers and families. So it provided childcare, it provided, you know.
Oh, man. Was that the first time? I guess it wouldn't. But, I mean, was the context of that something that you could identify as the result of these class issues and these is that where the some sort of awakening might have taken place about the nature of America?
Well, I think it was just, you know, I couldn't escape the feeling that I had to still be contributing something to society. You know, I mean, that was one of the biggest arguments we had. My dad and I was like, theater is a pursuit of the white bourgeois.
Yes.
And, you know, come to find out he was not wrong, like, you know, years later. But, you know, that you had to be making a contribution. So I felt like, okay, I was going to be an actor in Boston, which I was. I was auditioning and doing shows, but I was also doing that. I was like 21, 22 in my day.
Right. But that's interesting that, well, giving back, but the idea, the idealistic and probably a bit intellectual and romantic notion of theater being for the people and of the people is really limited by the amount of people that really give a shit about theater.
Exactly. I mean, directing movies now, right? You know,
but it's always there, that idea that that theater can function as some sort of community space.
I still believe it because I've done work where I have seen communities transformed by what we put on stage. But at the end of the day, and honestly, this is why I moved into film and television, the eyeballs are limited. And film and television just gets more people looking at it.
Yeah, but it's not as visceral, obviously, and it does not feel like there's nothing like the feeling of being at the theater and watching actors act and the play live. But it is not something that we somehow we're taught culturally to respect or engage with.
No, it is quite an elitist art form, isn't it?
Well, I guess so, or seemingly amateur. But it's not really.
No, not at all.
You know, but like I think that anything to a lot of people that isn't off-Broadway or a couple blocks away is somehow like it's either too weird or it's not. It's amateur, right? But I don't know where this stuff lives. You know, I mean, because I imagine at some point you were doing, you know, I don't know your whole resume, but the theater that you were started directing seemed to be around, you know, black issues, women issues.
Well, yes. And so like when I was in New York for a couple of years as an actor and I just felt like, oh God, I have no control over these projects.
Worst.
I have to wait on people. And also like some of this stuff is shit. And I was being some of the directors I was working with. I was like, these people don't know anything.
Yeah.
I felt like they didn't know how to block. I felt like they didn't know how to talk to actors.
Yeah.
And, you know, couple of shows, I became a force for darkness, because actors love nothing more than to hang out with people who are mad. Yeah, and like, what are you mad at? I want to be mad too.
Like,
you
know, day one, first rehearsal. What the fuck is this?
I know. And I was exuding dissatisfaction, ire. And they, you know, I started getting like this following of actors like, ooh, I'm going to be pissed with you.
I barely saw you get mildly cranky on set. And I was like, no, I don't want to be, if she got real mad, I don't even want to be in the room.
You were correct. But, you know, then I was like, this is actually not how I want to function. I don't want to be this pissed all the time. And I certainly don't want groupies of people pissed, you know, like secondary pissed.
You don't
want
to be the leader of the pissed.
No. Yeah. So I was like, I think I have to put my money where my mouth is.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, I'm going to start directing then if I think I'm so damn smart.
Right.
And I did. I worked in New York at, you know, a series of executive assistant jobs and then restaurant jobs, and I saved every penny and I self-produced like downtown off Broadway.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like, and what choices were you making?
So I did something called Shakespeare in the Parking Lot. And it's this parking lot in the Lower East Side. And
where?
I did a production of, oh gosh, Ludlow Street.
Okay,
I think.
Yeah.
And I did a production of Love's Labor's Lost there.
Did you get some attention?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I did this thing for The Fringe, an adaptation of Two Gentlemen of Verona called Two Girls from Vermont. And I put like, there's like drag queens in it and a whole bunch of Britney Spears songs. It was like a, you know, like a fiesta.
Thing, a fun, funny,
and people came
campy
to that.
Thing.
Yeah. And, you know, got a lot of attention. And what's funny is like, those were my early things when it was just left up to me.
Yeah.
And then I started working with playwrights like Tracy.
Yeah.
And Lynn Nottage and, you know, all these other incredible women. And then I started kind of becoming known as a person who did political theater.
Did you know Carly and Liz from Glow?
Yes, Carly, I knew.
Yeah.
She's
yeah.
the best.
Yeah.
So, you know, the thing just sort of organically morphed into material focused on like race and politics.
When
and
you
so
started
I did
working
that.
With playwrights.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But you know, I have this passion for music, for musicals. And so I did that for a while, and then
directed
I moved
musicals.
Mm-hmm, and then I moved into musicals and Shakespeare. I just wanted to do everything.
But it seemed like, you know, just from glancing over some of this stuff about you, that, you know, you were willing to move places to do the job.
Yeah. I love travel.
Well, what was that? Were those like, you would do, how, why were you in so many different places? Where would these places go? Did they have you out to do a run?
Yeah.
How it worked?
So they bring you out, you know, so I've worked all over East Africa. I've worked in Canada and, you know, I've worked with German writers, French writers, and then all over America. And what happens is they bring you out to whatever town for the rehearsal process. That's like 6 weeks.
To direct.
6 to 8 weeks to rehearse and direct. You know, each city has like a multi- $10 million, $20 million regional
But you
theater.
Represent taking an exciting risk.
Yes, I think that is true. And so some places, I was the first person who looked like me directing a play in that building.
Right.
You know, and so there, sometimes you're met with this like hostility and this expectation that you're some kind of, you know, affirmative action hire, even though it's 2010.
Yeah.
And other places, they're like, thank God, finally.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Right.
And so, you know, you just do your thing. You block out the resistance and skepticism.
That's so interesting, because those are the two ways of seeing it.
Yep.
And they still are. That
they
like
still are.
Because I talk to guys, you know, white writers who are my age, who are like, no, man. Yeah, I'm probably not going to get the job. They're probably going to give it to another type of person.
Another like, type of person.
Because the threat... I guess it is fundamentally insensitive at the least, and racist or misogynistic at the worst, right? But it's what's happening is actually a more competitive environment is unfolding.
That's exactly correct. And you know, there's something that really pisses me off is when, you know, you hear a writer or a director going, well, you know, it's just like, it's not my time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been your time for about 500 years, but okay. But the point, or like their agent told them that there's just like, there's no way.
Yeah,
and I want to say to them all, A, agents, stop saying that bullshit to your clients.
Right, yeah.
And B, look at the statistics. Yeah. It's not like we're taking over.
Yeah.
It's still minuscule.
And it's sincerely representational, but also it's really the fact that so many people have been carried along
yes.
by the system and their friends that, you know, it, the system has become myopic, mm-hmm. and it becomes impossible to have, you know, honest representation in the expression. So it, what's really frightening to these guys is not so much they're just, you know, aggravated white guys who feel like they're being pushed out, but it's become honestly competitive.
Honestly competitive. Finally.
Exactly. And what you stand to gain from that is a widening of the vision.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, listen, even like look at this movie, me and Tracy working on this movie. Even 5 years ago, a big studio film like this would have probably had a white dude writing it and a white dude directing it, even though it was about a black woman's life.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So the fact that it was the two of us is still an anomaly, a big studio movie like this. Mm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's just like the progress is incremental still.
Sure. Sure, but they do. It's funny because it's like I keep trying to figure out how to phrase this, but they seem to be having some success in integrating fictional representations of people. Yeah, I don't know.
True.
I don't know if it's going to actually fix the things in the real world, but it looks like the fake world is becoming a little more diverse.
That is correct. Oh man, for real.
But I mean, I think it has to have you know, positive implications around just, you know, in terms of the, you know, at the helm, but then that spreads out. So, you know, whatever Jennifer's comfort level will be. I mean, it's just like no matter how non-racist or progressive, you know, a white executive or a white director or a white producer is going to be, and we, you know, we've all learned to live with this, but the connection is going to run deeper if you're like-minded and of the same ilk as the person, right?
I think that's true. And there's also just like a level of authenticity
organic
that you have to fight for.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So in terms of like the sort of capturing... Because, like, there is a focus. Like, I just watched all of Barry Jenkins' Underground Railroad. And it had a profound effect. I mean, there's been, like, the last few weeks have been sort of profound for me somehow around this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I don't know really why. But, you know, that the attention he pays to this, I didn't read the book, but it becomes sort of like a poetic examination, a filmic examination of the foundation of American racism and the brutality of it. Mm-hmm. And the only counter valence to it and the only means of survival was community, tenderness, some faith, but just that humanity somehow. Yes. And he really manages that, you know? And the way he portrays the black experience and his passion and focus on the aesthetic of the black body is something he's highly aware of, and it's a celebration in all its horror.
His way of shooting the black body is so profound. I mean, I thought in Moonlight was a revelation.
And how did you conceive? Like you must have been aware of how you were going to approach that.
Absolutely. I mean, the way I think about this movie, you know, is so I grew up watching a lot of classic Hollywood movies with my grandma.
Yeah.
And she loved Grace Kelly. She loved those kinds of glamorous, beautiful, you know, beautifully dressed, highly stylish, you know, Hollywood glamour. But we never ever saw any movies with ourselves in them. Mm. And so I knew that part of what I wanted to do with Respect is create a film like that, like a classic Hollywood movie with glamour and beauty where you wanted to wear those clothes and sit on that mid-century chair and drink that cocktail.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Drink that bourbon
the
way that they are. Because that's how I think when you're doing period right, that's what you want. You want to just sink into it.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to make that kind of movie that my grandmother would have just absolutely loved to see herself in. So there was definitely an aesthetic to that. And also, you know, Kramer and I talked a lot about, you know, lighting the black characters, and I just wanted black people who watch this film to feel bathed in love.
You know what was great? And I think that definitely comes through, but it was, you know, black hair when you wake up. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so like that, you don't really see that.
Yeah.
Right? So there's a couple of scenes with Jennifer where she's, you know, in bed or getting it together, and certainly towards, you know, the breakdown, where the honesty of what it implies is the effort it takes to be presentable to a white culture.
Correct. 100%.
As a black person.
Yes, 100%. Yeah, and that again, that comes from the writer or the director having a lived experience of walking around Earth with our black hair. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, so for me, it was really like I wanted to make a beautiful film. I wanted it to be aspirational and romantic and feel like all the things that Hollywood has done to inspire us visually, we could have in this movie. For black people, too.
Yeah, and I think that came across, and it's great. And also, it was like when I've been doing these interviews and talking about it, you know, the movie, like, you know, where there's a couple of moments that she like sort of transcends, like when Aretha had to sing at national events, well, mostly at Martin Luther King's funeral. A national event of mourning that Jennifer had to do the song and do the acting. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was sort of amazing.
It's astounding what she did.
Yeah.
It's astounding. I remember actually at that scene that you're talking about, the MLK Memorial, Forrest Whitaker coming up to me and saying, you know, he said, this feels like a religious experience.
Well, yeah.
You know?
And then you really, like when I watched it last night, I'm like, well, you know, she is, personally has a resource of grief.
She does.
Right?
She really does.
Yeah.
It was, you know, at times I thought to myself, what kind of an asshole are you asking her to go to these places and to do, and,
yeah.
you know, to right. do these things?
Yeah. You're, yeah.
Like, what's wrong with you? But right. all I can say is we knew that those days were going to be brutal. Some of it was not. It was really, really hard.
Was it?
Yeah. I mean, I remember one day. We were actually working on that scene
Which?
In the church where she has the breakdown and she's singing Precious Memories and she's singing about her mother. And she, you know, we had to take a break. I think we were doing a turnaround. And she was sitting in the aisles and she was just still crying because whatever she had to do to get herself there, she was still there, you know. Mm. That's the thing people don't understand. You don't say cut and then you're like, wipe your tears. Like to get, as an actor, to get yourself into such a harrowing emotional place, you don't turn it on and off.
It's weird when you open it up. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's what Marlon was saying to me all the time.
Yeah.
And I went up to her and she just kind of looked up at me and there was just like a haze and she said, "Is it over yet?" And I said, "No, honey, we're going to do a turnaround."
Turn it around.
And then she just like sort of sat back and I literally watched her keep the ball in the air.
Yeah.
You know, so that she could finish it.
That was a long day in that church. I was there.
It was a long day.
When she did for the recording of the movie part?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, those extras were getting salty.
I know. Rowdy. we had all the church scenes, those Atlanta extras, they felt like they were, that it was their movie and they had ownership and they were, you know, it was church for them every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was real.
So it's really going to be interesting to see how these different communities who hold her so dear. I mean, I think most people who like music do. But I think that, you know, the black community and the gay community are going to be the deciders on this.
You think
one.
So?
Do you?
Yeah, or the fans are.
And the church, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think people of faith for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, I this movie has already... You know, even I've had interviews with journalists who were very moved by it.
Oh, no, you can tell when you talk to people.
Yeah.
When they've seen it and they're like, hey.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not sort of like, so they're not picking angles, you know, where they're trying to avoid saying anything positive.
Yeah, they literally just want to talk about all the parts of the movie, which is always like, thank God.
Yeah.
You know, because I just focus on making it, but when I ever allowed myself to take a second and step back and go, you're making the Aretha Franklin biopic. You know, you could just want to kill yourself.
Yeah, right.
It's so overwhelming.
Sure.
You know, you just stay focused, you know, in the moment.
And also you had this chunk, right? So you had this story. So, I mean, on some level, you must have found a certain amount of solace in that.
Yeah.
You're not, you know, you're making the biopic, but just till 72.
That's right. That's right. I'm no fool.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thanks, Mark.
And it was great talking to you. Great working with you. And
likewise.
I appreciate you casting me.
True pleasure. And you killed it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Liesl Tommy. and me talking about the movie she directed with me in it. Respect, starring me and Jennifer Hudson and Marlon Wayans. Respect, with me in it, is in theaters now. Here, I'm going to play that Les Paul now. Yeah, it's going to happen. Monkey LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.